My teacher started a creamery. It was most certainly my first introduction into entrepreneurship and starting a company. I was captain of my baseball team, but I liked writing. I was the editor of my school newspaper. I ended up being a finance major. My dad was facilitating that. So he would work with these people and all different levels of sophistication, you know, people applying for the loans, and he was trying real hard to make their dreams happen. I did a JD MBA. So it was Albany Law. When I went over to the MBA and I started taking the business classes again, I just realized how much more fun and exciting for me, how much more satisfaction I got out of learning about business. My best friend, who ultimately passed away back in 2012 and was the genesis of the business. His name's Kevin Kless. He was, you know, Warwick High School guy with me. We were best friends. We would play baseball. We were both on the varsity baseball team together, both outfielders. 2012 that he was killed. It was a random act of violence, kind of a really unfortunate situation. What we learned was there was somewhat of a delay in getting a responder to the scene. His friends, they didn't know where they were, in a state of shock. You know, thought there's gotta be a smarter, more effective way to call for help. And that's how the company was born originally. So I had met my co-founder. So Lucas Lompe is my co-founder. He's our CTO. Him and I had connected in the MBA degree. He's a German engineer. He got a scholarship to study business. Conceptualized, you know, a mobile version of the blue light poles. That was our original, you know, thinking about it. We quickly moved away from that and we added the device itself. For reasons that 911 is not adequate enough.
What, such as?
So, first of all, you have to fish your phone out of your pocket. You can't do it discreetly. If you do get the call out, which you might, they don't get the information that they need. So most 911 centers aren't gonna get your GPS location at this point, which is really surprising. A lot of people don't realize that. I'm also gonna call a county dispatcher. Okay. So if you're a student on campus, the county dispatcher then has to call local police, and usually local police will then call campus police. We started with like about a dozen schools that we were just trying to gather information from. Actually spent an entire weekend in a 911 center to see what that looked like. So trying to figure out exactly how it should work for each stakeholder that's part of the system. Our first deal was for 1,500 units at Sage College. I had a few, and one in particular, people that were real champions for this. Yeah. Director of Residential Services and the VP of Student Affairs. Both of them were huge champions of the product. We kind of hacked it together. So we found a partner that had these little buttons that they had used. I would say it's about the size of a half dollar.
So let me really...
Yeah. So they come custom branded. You can do them in school colors. It's Howard University. It's the blue and the white. It's got Howard on the back.
What happens if you press it in your pocket? I mean, it's conceivable.
It's a triple tap to activate the emergency call.
Got it.
So the triple tap will start the emergency response and do all the things that I explained. GPS, profile, two-way voice call. It's another thing too. It's got a speaker and a microphone on it.
What's the battery life?
10 to 14 days. We rewrote the firmware. We hooked them into the system and we sold 1,500 of them to Sage College. Oh, we made a ton of mistakes. With hardware, you have to do a lot with user experience.
We are literally right here on a college campus. And let's just take a look around. Tell me if you see a blue light. Tower.
Let's see.
I'm see that.
There's one.
Okay, so there is one, but let's just show them. So can you point it out? Where is it?
So it's
about
tucked over there
60,
in that corner.
50 feet away. So if there's something happening here, it could be really difficult conceivably to like get over to that.
The app will manage the device's settings. It's how you connect it. It's how you build your profile.
Did anyone actually use it?
Yes. So right when we first deployed, three freshman girls, they went out to a bar downtown, spent the night, you know, at this bar, left at 3 o'clock in the morning, got turned around trying to get home and thought some guy was following them.
Yeah.
So one of them pulled out their palm, activated it, told them what was going on. They actually had a patrol car come out and meet them. From the very beginning was, how do we design something that's going to be foolproof? We make our own devices now. So we're on the third generation of the product. We had a really good use case with Sage. Sage loved it. Sage, this year was their fourth year. Very happy. Yeah, there'll be a client from 2015 to 2023. The triple tap is the emergency call. The long hold, you can program to do some other things. So you can hold the button down and you can have that make a fake phone call to your phone. Backup, instead of a fake call, an actual person, you can hold the device down and send a discreet text message with your location to one or multiple people. So long press, you can customize to be one of three things.
Oh, that's where the app comes in.
You're out networking and you're done, you know, talking. I tell VCs, it works for you too.
So he was just monopolizing my time. I needed an out.
We knew we had something, right? We were able to raise a little bit of money based on our success with Sage.
So even though you had traction, you know, what was the most difficult part about pitching?
What wasn't the most difficult part about pitching?
Boom.
it's a grind. And it's a lot of falling on your face and getting back up, trying to iterate based on what you know. Three come in, and those are the three you need.
You know, how many college campuses are you at today?
35. We've got about 15,000 devices deployed across all of those schools. Other traction, just this year, we made a shift into healthcare.
Why does healthcare need this device? Like, what are the use cases?
Nurses and nurse aides are assaulted 5 times more frequently, but it's predominantly women going into people's homes throughout the community. One-on-one, by themselves. There's no backup, there's nobody else. So we created a consumer product, created an online shop. Anyone can go to the website and buy one now. Realtors was one persona that kind of
bought. If I buy the button, is there a monthly fee?
$10 a month for the.
How does it feel having this responsibility?
It's a little unnerving, but it's also very rewarding. Abusive relationship. She got the palm and she activated her palm and the dispatcher's voice came in through the palm. So the guy heard it, he took off running, and they caught him down the street. Incredible to actually hear her testimony. You know, all the people that take the calls are professionals. Our mission is to provide a new level of peace of mind to, you know, anybody.
How do you think you've grown as an entrepreneur?
Perseverance, like I didn't know how determined I really was as a person to accomplish something that I set out to do until I went through this process. I feel like that's the craft I've been mastering most, is how do you effectively communicate to convey your vision, to persuade people to take action, and keep your ears open for ways to improve. Getthepalm.com.
That's got a great ring.
Getthepalm.com. Palm stands for peace of mind, so it's POM.
Hello, startup hunters. Thank you guys so much for listening. This podcast would be nothing without you. And also, this podcast is a startup, so I need all the help that I can get. Would you please leave me a good review in the App Store? This would be huge. That's it. On to the episode.
Welcome to Startup Hunter. I am here with AJ Leahy of Peace of Mind, which connects people with the help they need when they need it. So on this show, I don't know if you've seen it, we go all the way back. And before we even get into your day-to-day of peace of mind, I want to know how you were formed.
Okay.
So, in a business sense. And where were you born, AJ? And also, what did your parents do?
I was born in Ridgewood, New Jersey. I grew up in Warwick, New York, which is right over the border there in Orange County. My mom's a dental hygienist. My dad is in banking. He does small business loans for banks and credit unions.
Now, does he have his own business?
He doesn't, no. Right now he works for TD Bank.
Neither of your parents were entrepreneurs?
No, yeah. No. Interestingly, I did, when I was in eighth grade, my teacher started a creamery. So it was an ice cream place. They made their own ice cream. It was amazing. And my professor asked me to be on the team, the initial.
What did you do at the creamery?
I was scooping ice cream all summer.
Right.
But it was cool because I saw it from the very, very beginning. I was there the first day they ever opened. I worked there all throughout high school, so I was there for 5 years. And I think, looking back on it now, it was most certainly my first introduction into entrepreneurship and starting a company. So it was cool to kind of go through that at an early age in high school.
So I want to dig, though, even further back as a kid. Do you remember the first hustle that you may have ever had, selling lemonade or, you know, just something? It didn't have to be actually changing money from hand to hand, but something where you're being productive or organizing.
You know, I was always a sports guy, so I played sports my whole life. So my hustle was like trying to make different teams and going, you know, going to practices and things like that.
Sports was your life.
Yeah, it really was. And all types of sports too, because not only would I play baseball and basketball, but I was like, skateboarding and snowboarding on the weekends. So like I had kind of a wide range of friends that I would hang out with, all different types of people. I think that helped me become very comfortable, you know, early on talking to people and kind of understanding where different perspectives.
Were you ever the captain of a team?
I was captain of my baseball team.
So leadership right there. And did you, what were you, first base, pitcher?
I was a pitcher and I was a center fielder. I was actually got a scholarship from my high school for baseball, and it was just, you know, money to go towards tuition my first year wherever I went. So it was definitely a big part of my life, and it's actually coincidentally and where I met my best friend, who ultimately passed away back in 2012 and was the genesis of the business.
Wow, that's heavy. So but before we get to this really traumatic moment, I want to focus on the sort of kernels. Were you captain of your baseball team just senior year or?
Yeah, my senior year. I was on varsity for my sophomore year.
Okay.
So they brought me up, which is kind of special.
Not too many sophomores in varsity.
One.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was cool. It was really cool. It was a good experience. You know, I started from sophomore year through my senior year. It wasn't D1 quality in terms of a prospect, but I could have gone on to play at a D3 or a D3.
Now, was that because were academics important to you?
Yes. Yeah, they were. I was a pretty smart kid. I was the oldest. So my parents, they paid a lot of attention, you know, made sure my grades were good, so I couldn't really slip up. Like, B's weren't acceptable, so I had to get A's. So I did well in school, and it kind of came pretty easy to me, to be honest. I didn't have to work too hard in high school. It wasn't really until I got to college that I actually had to study and kind of, you know, pay attention to it. So I was lucky in that regard.
Yeah. Now, which topics did you like to study? Did you gravitate to?
I was a good writer. So for a little while in high school, I thought it was going to be a journalism major. Glad I didn't go down that path.
Why not?
Well, it's a lot different now than it was back in 2005.
Sure. I mean, this is journalism.
This is journalism, for sure. For sure. But I liked writing. I was the editor of my school newspaper.
Oh, so I'm glad I asked that, because there's another leadership position.
Yeah.
Now, did you intend, like, were you always gunning for editor, or did it just sort of fall in your lap because you had always done it for all 4 years?
I did it for three of the 4 years. I wasn't gunning for it per se. I was just very involved. So I think it was, you know, by the time I got to my senior year, it was kind of asked, would you like to have this position? So I like to think I earned it by merit.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, so I accepted it, and it was great. I learned a lot. I definitely honed my communication skills. I think it's been helpful as the rest of my career has gone on. So yeah, that was kind of another piece of my childhood that I think made an impact on who I am now.
And by the way, we're here in Newark, New Jersey. So AJ is just showing me his streets. And look, there's a for rent right there. Is this city is there a lot of, you know, vacant space? Is there, like, what's going on in this city?
It's in a transformational stage for sure. It's definitely, it's got pockets where there's a deliberate effort for everyone to kind of revitalize. So it's got the look and feel of a city that's kind of undergoing things that happened in Jersey City, in Hoboken even years ago, out in Brooklyn. You know, so there are, it's kind of a mix. It's interesting. It's cool. It is. It's really cool. Newark's great. You know, when we got the investment from MVP, we knew we were going to move into the space. So, you know, for a lot of reasons, it did make sense. The space is fantastic. We love it.
But okay, we'll get to that. We'll get to that.
Yep.
So let's get back to college. So were you recruited to play D3 or no?
There was a couple of schools that were interested in me coming there. There weren't schools I really had any interest in going to. I actually decided after my senior year of baseball that I was not going to play in college.
Interesting.
So I got two jobs that summer and didn't play any summer
ball. What were your jobs?
I was at the Creamery.
Oh, okay. So, still there?
Yeah, so that was my fifth year there. And I was a lifeguard.
Yeah.
So I was working at Mountain Creek up in Vernon, New Jersey as a lifeguard. And so I was really, really busy that summer. I was just trying to make money. You know, I didn't play summer ball for the first time. And actually, I got onto campus. I had talked to the University of Delaware's coach.
So that's where you went to school?
Which is where I ultimately decided to go to school. And he, you know, I really wasn't up to the caliber for D1, but we had a relationship. So he called me up the first week and was like, hey, there's a couple open spots. Why don't you come and do, you know, a bullpen session, you know, come do an inter-squad scrimmage. So I did both of those things.
Okay.
Bullpen session went fine. Inter-squad scrimmage, I got rocked. I think it went maybe two or three batters and they pulled me. And my arm was pretty much hanging off at that point because I hadn't played all summer.
Right.
So that was, instead I joined a fraternity and.
Now, what did you actually like gravitate to? Like, was writing what you did in were you an English major?
No, so I ended up being a finance major. So by the time I got to the end of high school, I decided that, you know, I wasn't going to do journalism. I had a few business classes that I really enjoyed. And I figured that, you know, University of Delaware had a really good business program. So I was going to do business. I came in business undecided and went and picked finance.
Now, do you think your dad had anything to do with that since he's a finance guy? Do you think he sort of pushed you or nudged you in that direction?
I was exposed to it, you know, my whole life. So
okay,
I definitely...
So that's actually sort of interesting. So like, talk about how you were exposed to finance, you know, your whole life. Were you like following stock prices from a young age?
I wasn't following stock prices per se. I mean, by the time I got into my senior year of high school, the economics class I took, you actually subscribed to the Wall Street Journal and you had to follow some of the stock prices. So that was more, you know, coming from my schooling. But with my dad, you know, he would be doing business at home, same as in the office. And so he would kind of fill me in on certain deals that he was involved in and, you know, the different things that went into getting certain deals done.
What do you think is the most interesting thing about, you know, his career?
I think, and this parallels to what I ended up doing, that the people that were going to him for loans are small businesses. So they are truly like trying to start their own thing. So this is like them going out, trying to start the American dream. You know, they want to open up a cafe. They want to open up, you know, a restaurant.
Wine store.
Yeah, wine store, you know, anything like that. So it's, you know, regular people that are kind of taking their own risk and, you know, going out and trying to make it happen. And my dad was facilitating that. So he would work with these people and all different levels of sophistication, you know, people applying for the loans. And he was trying real hard to make their dreams happen from a financial perspective. So I think that rubbed off on me. One thing that was cool, he actually did a skate park down in North Carolina called Hang Loose Skate Park. And we got invited to the opening. Dave Mira was there. Ryan Nyquist was there. A whole bunch of skaters were there. So it was cool. So I, you know, he would bring me along to, you know, some of the end results of his loans and his deals.
I'm sure the fact that you were a skater somehow influenced him. Like, if you weren't a skater, he might not have picked that deal.
Yeah. So yeah, for sure. I mean, it's always been like a mile wide and an inch deep with me. So like, I like very curious about things. I like to meet new people. You know, so being a skater, being an athlete, being on I think it's just art.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like tires and burnt wood. So you've always been exposed to finance, and then so you get to college, business undecided, and what were some highlights from that?
So I mean, it was a great experience, to be honest. I found some of my best friends just that first year. They were also finance majors. It was kind of funny. A lot of the people that we ended up being around, whether it was in our dorms or, you know, wherever, were either like biology or business, you know, so they're either going into the health or they're going into, you know, finance or business. So a lot of my friends were business guys and we all kind of wanted to be on Wall Street together. That was the goal. So as a finance major, I picked up a legal studies minor halfway through it.
Uh-huh. Which is a great combination.
Yeah, and ultimately went to law school.
Oh.
So I kind of took both of those things. The law degree and the interest in law might have come from my predilection to writing, because it's mostly writing. Not creative writing, but writing nonetheless. And, you know, so I decided I was going to try and go to law school, and I did. Went to Albany Law. Did a JD MBA. So it was Albany Law.
And how long is the JD MBA program?
It's 3.5 years.
Yeah, so that's like, so, now what year are we talking?
So I graduated college 2011, so, and I went right into law school.
So it feels to me like college is becoming shorter. Like there's a trend happening towards community colleges, or just don't go to college, you know, go to tech school for, So the whole, you know, 3.5 year at JD MBA, I think there was a time when JD MBA was like 4 years, you know? So maybe it was already starting to shorten.
It is, and it depends on what your undergraduate degree was in, but because I was finance, so many of the credits for the MBA transferred over, and if I did 2 summers, I'd be able to do the whole thing in 3.5 years.
Oh, okay, so we're talking a lot of work.
Yeah, you're talking full time, you don't have another job, you're just studying you know, and trying to get the degrees done.
Now, you said law to you is writing, which to me maybe says, are you more introverted than extroverted?
I don't think so. Yeah. I'd say I'm more of an extrovert than an introvert.
Because when I think of law, I think of, you know, Matlock doing his investigative journalism, but also, you know, arguing, you know, these sizzling court cases, you know, and just. You know, that's what I think of when I think of a lawyer.
Most people do. And all my friends did too. Like there's a few of us that thought we'd go to law school. I ended up going right away. Some of the other ones got jobs and were planning to do it a couple years later. And I called them after the first semester. And I was like, look, you've really got to think twice about this, because it's not like Matlock, right? It's not like Law and Order.
Although there are some attorneys, you know, doing these really interesting social media ads that are, I don't even, they're really interesting.
It is. The thing about it is, it's, unless you really, really want to practice law, you shouldn't go to law school. And practicing law is, it's research, it's very introverted, to be honest. I think this would kind of push me away from it. You're in a library, you're doing research all day, you're going through case law, you know, you're trying to interpret opinions and come up with your own case. And it's, a lot of it's procedural, so it's just kind of paperwork.
Although I have a buddy of mine who's he's a really extroverted lawyer, really thinks differently.
I got you!
We have like the exact same personality profile, so he managed to like, find his way, you know.
So, and I really am generalizing, and I'm talking more about corporate law than, say, maybe going to criminal law, where there might be more excitement and some things going on that,
oh, yeah,
you know, are more directly working with a client and helping them out. Corporate law is a lot of, you know, you're working with a company and trying to get them whatever it is they're trying to accomplish.
So you were in law school and you were already getting like psyched out. You were getting demotivated. You're like, you could get the sense that like, you don't want to be doing this for the rest of your life.
I was getting the seeds of that thought for sure. But I did well in my first year. And I did not hate it. right? So I wasn't sitting there like I'm miserable. I enjoyed it. I went, the way that the JDMBA worked is you do a year, you do your 1L for law school, then you go do a year of the MBA, and then you go back for a year and a half of the law degree. So when I went over to the MBA and I started taking the business classes again, I just realized how much more fun and exciting for me, how much more satisfaction I got out of learning about business, learning about business management, and you know, even finance at the time. I was pretty heavily involved in advanced corporate finance and things like that. I still wanted to be on Wall Street. So, you know, I just enjoyed it so much more. Now, by the end of that second year, I was kind of dreading going back to the law degree.
And right.
I wasn't really sure if it was for me. But that's actually when I met my co-founder and the whole business happened.
So, of peace of mind?
Yes.
Okay, so I did interrupt you or ask you to fast forward. So now's a good time to get back to that. You did say that one of your college buddies passed away?
It was one of my high school best friends in high school.
So talk about that.
So his name's Kevin Kless. He was, you know, Warwick High School guy with me. We were best friends. We would play baseball. We were both on the varsity baseball team together, both outfielders. And then we were both snowboarders. So again, same type of thing. We'd play baseball all day, throw our snowboards in the car, go snowboarding all night. And we did that for years. We were really best friends. He went to Temple University undergrad. I went to UDel. So it's only a 30-minute SEPTA train. So we saw each other all 4 years of college. I went up to Albany Law for my law degree, and he stuck around in Philly, close to by Temple University. And it was back in 2012 that he was killed. It was a random act of violence, kind of a really unfortunate situation where really a miscommunication happened between him and another guy who was walking home with two of his friends one night and got into an altercation with a group of men on the street. Fight broke out. He hit his head and was knocked unconscious, and he ultimately passed away. And what we learned was there was somewhat of a delay in getting a responder to the scene. His friends, they didn't know where they were, in a state of shock. You know, so they had to call out for help, but had to run to the nearest cross street to explain where they were. And I was doing the MBA part of everything at this point and kind of walking around campus realizing there's got to be a smarter way to call for help. The, you know, they were, you know, not all that far from a blue light pole, which are the de facto standards on college campuses for calling emergency services, which is essentially a glorified telephone booth. You run up, you press a button, calls into the campus police. You have to be literally within arm's reach to use one. So we, you know, thought there's got to be a smarter, more effective way to call for help. And that's how the company was born originally.
So what did you do first?
So I had met my co-founder. So Lucas Lompe is my co-founder. He's our CTO. Him and I had connected in the MBA degree. He's a German engineer. He got a scholarship to study business in America. You know, we met over whiskeys at a bar one night and talking about all different ideas that we both had. We both had kind of a, you know, a list of different business ideas, and we were bouncing them off each other. So we started doing some extracurricular activities, and you know, when this tragedy happened, you know, we kind of got together and we're like, look, there's got to be something we can do. And Lucas had already built some location-based apps in the past, you know, so he had coded some software and was pretty involved with technology at that point. So we conceptualized, you know, a mobile version of the blue light poles. That was our original, you know, thinking about it. It was an app at first. We quickly moved away from that and we added the device itself.
Okay, so let's talk about, you know, you say we need a solution, we have a problem. How can we make first responders, you know, get to a scene faster. So you make an app at first?
Yeah, we...
So here's a really basic question.
Yeah.
Why not just call 911?
So there's a couple reasons that 911 is not adequate enough.
What, such as?
So first of all, you have to fish your phone out of your pocket, you know, unlock it, dial 911. You can do the side activation with iPhones, not really with Androids. You can do all that, but you still have to kind of fumble for your phone, get it out. It takes time, it takes your attention, you know, away from the situation. You can't do it discreetly. You know, so there's a number of things that aren't great with that. And then the actual, if you do get the call out, which you might, they don't get the information that they need. So most 911 centers aren't gonna get your GPS location at this point, which is really surprising. A lot of people don't realize that. There's a movement to kind of change that, but at current state of things is most of them will get the cell tower that it pinged off of, or a triangulation, cell tower triangulation, but it's not getting you, not going to get your live GPS location.
Right, so that's a problem.
Oh, most definitely. It's also gonna call a county dispatcher. So okay. If you're a student on campus, the county dispatcher then has to call local police, and usually local police will then call campus police.
Okay.
So there's a few different kind of chains there that you'd have to go through in order to get the help you need. So for us, we figure why not send it to the department that is closest to the incident, presumably. You know, they have access to the dorms, they have access to the different buildings, they know how to get there. So it's sending a quicker, you know, it's activating a quicker alert, sending better information to the department that is most appropriate to handle that incident.
So I want to know about the app. Like, did it work? Did it not work when you first launched it?
It had a lot of fundamental flaws.
What was?
Again, I think one of the big ones was you have to fish your phone out, unlock it, leaf through pages of apps.
Right.
You find the right little icon on the screen. So, you know, in an emergency, you don't have the time or presence of mind to go through those steps. It's a lot to ask someone to do. So we thought there should just be an easier way to activate the emergency call, which would be with a button connected to the phone that would initiate the emergency response.
Okay. Did you spread this app to real people?
We started with like about a dozen schools that we were just trying to gather information from. So we went to the Syracuse University, University of Albany, Sage, you know, Siena College, all these different schools, all different types of people. We actually spent an entire weekend in a 911 center to see what that looked like. So trying to figure out exactly how it should work for each stakeholder that's part of the system.
Now, how did you, you know, gravitate to schools?
So it was pretty much because of the statistics we had learned about and talking with people and the situations they'd been in. Yeah, we worked with a whole bunch of schools. We worked with different students. We worked with administrators, with campus police, just trying to map out how this should all work and whatever should do and should look like.
And this is what, 2 years ago?
No, this was back in 2014.
Okay.
So we were just really trying to understand everything. You know, we landed on the device. The device connected to the phone, called into campus police. They had backend security that would monitor, you know, the students and the emergency alerts. And we had rolled it out in a beta. So we did 1,500 users.
With devices? 15.
Yeah.
So how'd you get the money for all this?
They paid. So we sold.
You got.
Our first deal was for 1,500 units at Sage College.
Why would they pay? Okay, here's just, why would they pay somebody who has zero experience or, you know, like 1 year of experience in this field? How did you get this deal to happen?
We spent the first 6 months piloting it with them. So we spent essentially the fall semester deploying it to some of their students in a pilot. We would collect feedback every week. We were doing surveys, we were doing focus groups, and we kept the administration highly involved in it.
So were they just like receptive from the start, or did you have to work to get them to even do the pilot?
We did. We had a few, and one in particular, people that were real champions for this.
Yeah.
So you will find that there's certain people that gravitate to it, that understand how it can really help folks and will try their hardest to bring it out to campus. We had the Director of Residential Services and the VP of Student Affairs. Both of them were huge champions of the product.
Now were you just like strangers hanging out on the campus? You know, did you sort of...
Initially, yeah.
Yeah, so here you are, like a stranger. They must have been skeptical, but somehow you were so determined that you managed to get some people, you know, interested in your mission. And
it was doing little things to build trust. I mean, that's the whole thing with selling B2B, but especially selling to colleges, you have to build trust with them. And it's really, you know, you have to build a relationship with them. So we started small. We started with a small group of students. It was all the RAs that worked with the res director. And we piloted with them. They loved it. So then we expanded the program. They got, you know, about 100 devices, and they deployed at different cross sections, seniors, juniors.
This is the college is paying for this.
No, not yet.
So this is
like our first 6 months of just piloting it. We piloted it for free.
Now with an actual device?
Yep.
So your co-founder's a tech guy. Now where did you manufacture these things?
So we kind of hacked this one too. So we found an off the shelf device.
Sweet.
So originally we were going to build our own. We were going to, you know, we would have to design the device. We'd have to design out the chipset, write the firmware, do the whole thing, and then manufacture it. And, you know, we're scratching our heads because we don't have all that much money. You know, we're trying to pitch fundraising, but having a manufacturing thing doesn't make fundraising any easier. So we kind of hacked it together. So we found a partner that had these little buttons that they had used, that they had built. It was really before there was Bluetooth in cars. You could put it on your keys and you could take a phone call through the device, you know, which kind of hung from your steering wheel, more or less. But it had a button on it so you could, you know, hang up calls and answer the call without touching your phone.
Right, and so I mean, this space, it sort of exists because I remember there was an advertisement about 15 years ago. I've fallen and I can't get up. You know that ad?
Yeah, of course.
So, and that's a similar system because you press a button, you get to speak to a responder.
Right. So it's a similar concept. The technology's different.
Well, you get GPS first of all.
Oh yeah, you get GPS location. You have a two-way voice call with, you know, the actual on-campus police. It's smaller, you know, so it's about
do
the
you
size
have one?
Of. Yeah, of course I do. But I would say it's about the size of a half dollar.
So let me really...
Yeah. So they come custom branded. You can do them in school colors. It's Howard University. It's the blue and the white. It's got Howard on the back. Can you see? So this? It easily clips onto you.
Now here's... Okay, so here's the thing. What happens if you press it in your pocket? I mean, it's conceivable.
It's a triple tap to activate the emergency call.
Got it.
So the triple tap will start the emergency response and do all the things that I explained. GPS, profile, two-way voice call. It's another thing too. It's got a speaker and a microphone on it. So to actually talk back and forth with the dispatcher.
What's the battery life?
10 to 14 days.
So what do you do after that?
It's rechargeable.
Okay.
Rechargeable battery. Takes about 2 hours to go from fully dead to fully charged. And yeah, depending on how often you're activating the other features, it would be anywhere from 10 to 14 days battery life.
Okay, so you found these off-the-shelf things. And
we rewrote the firmware, we hooked them into the system, and we sold 1,500 of them to Sage College.
So yeah, rewriting the firmware is definitely where a technical co-founder comes in, but that did a lot of the work that you were
yeah, a lot of the investment and like the legwork that you have to lay down in order to get a manufacturer, you know, a product manufactured, we skirted by going this route initially.
You said Sage University was the first?
Yeah.
Where is that?
They're in Albany.
Oh, so that's where that's your territory.
Yeah, that's where we were at the time.
So you said for the first 6 months you're just doing pilot. No, the university isn't paying for it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the deal? The first deal that they made with you?
So it was, we took all the results from the pilot. We were pretty deliberate about tracking everything.
And actually, that's actually more important than even the business deal is. Like, you know, how what mistakes did you make at first?
Oh, we made a ton of mistakes. So we had these devices out there, we're piloting it. You know, the devices would make all these sounds, they would disconnect. One of the ones that always stuck with me, if the device was dying, right, you only had a couple hours left of battery, it would play this sound where it sounded like a phone ring, but it was kind of slowly tapering off. It annoyed people so much, we had the administrator come to us and go, you know, yeah, this thing almost ended my marriage last night. I go, what do you mean? She goes, the thing wouldn't stop ringing. So I ended up putting it in our guest, underneath our bed in our guest room on the bottom floor, because I didn't know what else to do. It wouldn't shut off. I couldn't get it to stop ringing. So, you know, with hardware, you have to do a lot with user experience, because it's a new piece of technology and different levels of tech savviness for your user base.
Now, okay, let's take just a quick minute. Yeah. We are literally right here on a college campus. And let's just take a look around. Tell me if you see a blue light. Tower.
Let's see.
I'm see that's
oh, there's one.
Okay, so there is one, but let's just show them. So can you point it out? Where is it?
So it's
about
tucked over there
60,
in that corner.
50 feet away. So if there's something happening here, it could be really difficult conceivably to like get over to that.
And unless you knew it was there, I mean, it took us a couple of minutes just to find it.
Right, so.
And we had the time to look around and, you know, actually see if we could find one.
Yeah.
If you're in the middle of a situation, it's unlikely.
Okay, so you had this weird noise happening. What are some other mistakes and, you know, that you corrected to make a better device?
It was a lot of user experience. I mean, one of the challenges was onboarding the users into the app and connecting their device.
So you have to have an app?
Yeah, it's connected to your phone. So you have the app on the phone, you have the device, and the app will manage the device's settings. It's how you connect it, it's how you build your profile. So getting people to connect the device properly, get into the app, kind of do the initial onboarding part was really, really a challenge for us. And we spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to make it seamless for the end user.
Okay, so you had these devices in the field. Did anyone actually use it?
Yes. So right when we first deployed with Sage College, the first weekend, maybe the second weekend, we had a couple of activations. The one that happened that, I think it was the second weekend, it was three freshman girls. They went out to a bar downtown. They spent the night, you know, at this bar, left at 3 o'clock in the morning, got turned around trying to get home, and thought some guy was following them.
Yeah.
So one of them pulled out their palm, activated it, told them what was going on. The dispatcher directed them, gave them turn-by-turn directions to, back to campus. They actually had a patrol car come out and meet them, and then took them back to their dorm to the point where they're, you know, still on the palm. You know, yeah, I've locked my door, I'm back, thank you so much. So it was intervening in a point where they definitely didn't have peace of mind. They felt nervous. Thought somebody might be following them, and, you know, stopped it before anything really bad happened.
Where was I? Oh yeah, you're talking about the three girls. They actually. So what I want to know is, here you are. You have this device that people are relying upon. I mean, you must have felt some kind of stress, you know, to operate something 24/7. And just talk about that, because you're sort of, you know, creating a first response like system.
Mm-hmm. It was a huge piece of what we had to think about and figure out from the very beginning was how do we design something that's going to be foolproof, fail safe? How does it, you know, how can we guarantee it's going to work 100% of the time? And so we made certain decisions around that to try and ensure that was the case. So first of all, we decided we were going to manufacture in the United States. So we manufacture in Rochester, New York.
So are you still buying the units? Or you don't have to answer?
No, we make our own devices now. So we're on the third generation of the product. Gen 2 was our first device that we ever made. Gen 3 is the version we're on right now, which again is our device. We design it. We, you know, did the industrial design for the clams, you know, the shell. We did the innards, you know, the board, all the firmware, you know, everything that it needs to connect to the phone and initiate the calls.
So this all just sounds expensive. So you how'd you go from Sage to a second university? Was the expansion like, talk about the expansion of your network.
Once we had a really good use case with Sage, Sage loved it. Sage this year was their fourth year. You know, so the end of the contract, they signed a four-year deal and they just re-signed for another 4 years. So they're very, very happy. Yeah, they'll be a client from 2015 to 2023. So it was really cool and they loved it. So we knew that we had a great referenceable customer. We knew we had a product that had legs. People were using it. It already saved somebody. It had been used in other use cases as well. I haven't really talked about, but there's non-emergency features that people use all the time.
What are the non-emergency features?
So the triple tap is the emergency call. The long hold, you can program to do some other things. So you can hold the button down and you can have that make a fake phone call to your phone. So let's say you're on a bad date, talking to somebody at a bar, they're getting inappropriate, they won't take a hint. You can hold the button down, create a fake phone call to your phone.
Oh.
It looks like, you know, you can save that caller ID. So it looks like
long hold.
Long hold.
That is genius.
So all of a sudden you take the call and you go, hey, what's going on? Oh, yeah, you know, it's your grandma and I got to take this call.
That right there is, holy cow, that I can see.
In that first year, we had about, well, really in the first semester, we had 63% of our users using the fake call.
Yeah.
If you wanted to get some backup instead of a fake call, an actual person, you can hold the device down and send a discreet text message with your location to one or multiple people. So hold it.
How do you do it? So long press is fake call.
So long press, you can customize to be one of three things.
Oh, that's where the app comes in.
There's a blue light pole.
Yeah.
You hold the button down. It can be programmed to do a fake call. You can have it text one or multiple people with your GPS location.
Right, and there's, like, I didn't really know this, but like, typically women, you know, might, before a date, you know, go to three friends and say, I'm going out with a date with this guy, I don't know. And just in case, you know, text me randomly at 8 p.m.
Yeah.
So now they can be in control of that, so I just see it.
You can do it on demand, so let's say everything's going well, your friend called you at 7:30, you felt fine then, but all of a sudden it's, you know, you're about to leave and the pushy, you just don't have a good feeling. You have the autonomy to decide what type of help you need. You know, do you need the police? Is it the most severe case? Do you need a friend?
Which is triple tap.
Which is triple tap. Do you need just a fake phone call to excuse yourself from the room and, you know, just kind of walk away? And
so yeah, there's uses even, you know, if you're not a woman, if you're like,
you're out networking and you're done, you know, talking. I tell VCs, it works for you too.
So literally there is about, this happened to me about a week ago. There was this guy who was talking to me for 45 minutes and it was just like, it's not what you do. I didn't want to be like, he was just monopolizing my time. I needed an out. And right. I didn't have one.
A nice, easy, friendly out. Hold the button down. And that's what you have. So as we've graduated from colleges, we have really seen that in different applications as well. So, and I don't, you tell me how you want me to.
Yeah, so I'm still curious, like.
Yes, go ahead.
The progression.
We started with Sage, because you asked this question, how did we get to more?
Yeah.
So we knew we had something, right? We were able to raise a little bit of money based on our success with Sage.
So right after Sage, you raised the money.
Yeah, we raised our first.
Friends and family.
Yeah, we did a little bit of friends and family before that. So this round, well, you know, because we had to figure out how to pay for all the development. Got us some salespeople.
Now, were you talking professional investors, like non-professional angels?
In this round, it was really more sophisticated angels.
Yeah, so sort of angels that know what are going on.
Yeah, that have done their own startups.
Now, was it difficult to pitch them?
Yeah.
Even though you had traction, You know, what was the most difficult part about pitching?
What wasn't the most difficult part about pitching?
Boom! Exactly.
It's a grind. And it's a lot of falling on your face and getting back up, trying to iterate based on what you learned, going for it again, falling down. So it's mostly failing. Like, you talk to 100 investors and, you know, 3 come in, and those are the 3 you need, right? That's just the game that you're in, is like, I got to talk to this many people to get this many that are interested, especially early on.
Were you getting a lot of, this isn't my space, or, you know, yeah, like, or were you just getting like, this is a cold intro, who is this guy?
So we helped ourselves out in no way. Not only were we first time founders, not only were we based in upstate New York, but we were building a hardware product. So it was hardware and software. And we're selling it to colleges.
And VCs are like, I don't do hardware. Hardware's too risky.
A lot of them are, you know, just based on their thesis, will not do hardware, which I understand, right? Like, if that's not your specialty, why would you, you know, want to be involved? You can't add too much value. And there's a lot of specialty when it comes to hardware. So yes, that just preempted us from working with a certain amount of VCs.
All right, so you raise some money, you get some development going, and you know, how many college campuses are you at today?
35.
So you've got 35, you still have 3,965 to go.
Very specific.
You know, for a total of 4,000. So, but at the same time, you're seeing some consumer options. So, you know, what's your plan to grow this company?
So we really have 2 market verticals at this point. We do the colleges, which has been our bread and butter. We've been selling the colleges for 3 years. We got 35 of them, and we got about 15,000 devices deployed across all of those schools.
That's not insignificant.
No, it was good. The growth rate wasn't what we wanted it to be with the team that we have right now. So there, it's just an extremely long sales cycle. A lot of the colleges' budgets are shrinking, and they have other competing priorities. So it's difficult. We found some other traction. Just this year, we made a shift into healthcare.
Oh, yeah.
So that has, we quickly, within 1 year, you know, it'll be a year really at the end of this year when we decided at the outset in January we were going to go into healthcare. We got about 12 contracts, so we averaged about 1 a month. And we found most of our momentum in the healthcare space.
So we talked about it off camera, but just again, talk about why does healthcare need this device? Like, what are the use cases?
So when we went out and we actually started focusing on healthcare because people were reaching out to us. So there's a lot of people raising their hands saying, hey, this might be interesting for us. So we paid attention. We learned that nurses and nurse aides are assaulted 5 times more frequently than other US workers, you and I and anybody else. And they're actually assaulted more frequently than police officers and prison guards.
And then there's the case of in-home nurses, which I can really see.
The most specifically, and where we've been getting our momentum in healthcare, has been with home care departments, home health. So these are men and women, but it's predominantly women, going into people's homes throughout the community, one-on-one, by themselves. There's no backup, there's nobody else, and they're in the patient's home. So there's risk there. There's risk that the patient might have their own set of, whether it's substance abuse or behavioral health issues. There might be other people in the home. There's dangerous pets. There's sometimes weapons. You can run into issues leaving late at night or after dark by yourself, going back to the parking garage, going, you know, back to your car, or even if you're taking mass transit. So there was all these, and they're just kind of out there by themselves. So there was, you know, a real pull from the market for a device like this. And
is there any competition out there?
Yes.
So how are you going to, you know, thrive with that?
So
that existing,
the competition kind of breaks down into 2 categories. There's apps and there's devices. So apps are, they're an alternative and they're less expensive, but they're pretty much not used. Colleges will buy apps. We've lost deals to app companies in the colleges. But they even will admit, if they're being candid, they know that only 2-5% of the students download it. They know that nobody ever uses them. It's really just, hey, I can tell parents that I have this and we check a box and we look good. In healthcare, the app is not a viable solution. So we have actually won deals from app companies because they piloted with an app and it failed miserably and they decided they needed a device. So there's other devices out there.
What about travelers? Travelers would be good.
So then as we looked at, you know, healthcare over the past year, we also saw other people raise their hand. We started paying attention to them. People, so we created a consumer product, created an online shop. Anyone can go to the website and buy one now.
But you can't get them on Amazon?
No.
And is that because you don't want Amazon, you're scared of Amazon?
We haven't made it a focus yet. So what we're still trying to learn with consumers is who is our buyer.
Yeah.
So a lot of what we've done, we launched our online shop in July and we've had some decent success. Right now we average about 2 subscriptions a day through our online shop, which is okay. But more importantly, we're figuring out who actually is buying them. So realtors was one persona that kind of bubbled to the top as most interested. So these are, again, men and women going into people's abandoned houses with strangers that called them up and said, hey, I want to check out this house.
I even need this button.
Everybody does. Yeah, why not? My wife carries it. So we see families, we see realtors, and we see like women in urban areas that are, you know, a little after college aged, up through, you know, their mid-40s, that are some jog at night when it's a little bit cooler, some commute after hours, you know, so they're coming back by themselves through a city. So like the whole purpose of launching the online shop was, of course, to make money, but really was to learn who would want something like this and in what ways are they using it that it adds value into their life.
So do you have some kind of like 24/7 staff or?
Yes, so we partnered with a group that does the 24/7 call monitoring.
Oh, so you have your own call. Oh.
So for anything that's not a campus, so a college campus or a hospital campus where they don't have a 24/7 security desk, they can use our dispatchers. So our dispatchers run the software. They'll get the calls. They'll see exactly where you are, who you are, what organization you're a part of, emergency contact info. Anything relevant for the first responders all shows up, along with the different municipal departments that they should call, whether it's the police, whether it's an ambulance, whether it's a fire truck. So they're kind of like a white glove 911 for either an individual or for an enterprise.
And so if I buy the button, is there a monthly fee?
Yes.
And what's the monthly fee?
It's $10 a month for the service, and then you buy the device. It's $50 for the device one time. We're running a special right now, so there's a significant discount as we're trying to get an early bird kind of test group together. So, but that's how it breaks down. Device fee, $50 and $10 a month.
So how does it feel? Like there's responsibility here, right? How does it feel having this responsibility in your hands?
Well, it's a little unnerving, but it's also very rewarding. I'll give you an example. So there was a woman and she was coming out of an abusive relationship. She got the palm and she activated her palm and the dispatcher's voice came in through the palm. So the guy heard it. He took off running and they caught him down the street and he went to jail. So it was incredible to actually hear her testimony because she just said so many of the things that we believed when we designed the concept, which was there was no way I was going to be able to get to my phone. You know, if I didn't have the device, it would have been worse because he wouldn't have heard that there's that the police are on the way.
Yeah.
So,
so what happens if you press the button and you say nothing because the situation you're in, you can't speak?
There's a protocol for that. So If you are an organization, you can kind of customize it, or if you're an individual, it's defaulted, but generally they're gonna send the police help. They can hear everything that's going on, even if you can't speak.
Yeah.
So if you activate it, you can't say anything, the microphone's still on, and right. they'll hear laughing, or they'll hear screaming.
Yeah, yeah.
They'll hear gunshots. And so they're professionals. They've been doing, you know, all the people that take the calls are professionals. They've been certified. They use their professional discretion to make the appropriate response.
What's your vision for Palm Peace of Mind?
Our mission is to provide a new level of peace of mind to, you know, anybody and everybody. We think that it's something that can be adopted into your lifestyle, no matter who you are. Even if you just have it so you can be empowered to help other people. You know, so for us, we're trying to put something out there that's really going to improve people's lives.
So, final question. And I think it's the most important question. I ask it to everyone on the show. How do you think you've grown as an entrepreneur, AJ? In what ways?
That's a good question. I would say that perseverance, like I didn't know how determined I really was as a person to accomplish something that I set out to do until I went through this process. A lot of it is picking yourself back up after you're falling down. So it's, you know, it's a lot of grinding and it's very taxing and you kind of get to your wit's end in terms of what you think you can handle. So I think I learned a lot about myself. And then I'd say like I grew in every way that you can in terms of communication. You know, I didn't know how to sell to, some of these contracts are, you know, $500,000 deals. I didn't know I could do that. I didn't know how to do it. I had, you know, no sales background, not much of a technical background. And, you know, so you learn all the basics of like, how do you prospect? How do you close a deal? How do you negotiate? Which is relevant to sales, but it's also relevant to fundraising, to employee management. You know, you got to recruit your team, right? It's a sales job in so many ways. And, you know, that I feel like that's the craft I've been mastering most, is how do you effectively communicate to convey your vision, to persuade people to take action, and keep your ears open for ways to improve.
There you go. So what's the website?
Getthepalm.com.
Oh, that's got a great ring.
Getthepalm.com. Palm stands for peace of mind, so it's P-O-M. Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Hunter. I appreciate it.
Yeah.